oyez, oyez. The Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas. All persons having business before the Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas, are admonished to draw near and give their attention. For the court is now sitting. God save the state of Texas and this honorable court.
Thank you. Be seated, please. Good morning. The court has three matters on its oral submission docket. In the order of their appearance, they are docket number 050801, S. Murphy Badiga, M.D. versus Mary Cruz Lopez from Hidalgo County and the 13th Court of Appeals District. Docket number 070043, Dynegy Midstream Services Limited Partnership and Versado Processors LLC versus Apache Corporation from Harris County and the 14th Court of Appeals District. And docket number 070419, N. Ray Labatt Food Service LP. And that's an original proceeding. Justice O'Neill is participating in each of these cases but could not attend oral argument this morning. The court has allotted 20 minutes per side for each argument and expects to complete all three before noon. We will take a brief recess between the arguments. These proceedings are being recorded, and a link to the arguments should be posted on the court's website by the end of the day today. The court is now ready to hear argument in 050801, Badiga versus Lopez.
If please the court, Ms. Faust will present argument for the petitioner. The petitioner has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court. Good morning. The issue in this case is fairly straightforward. Can and does the Court of Appeals have jurisdiction over an interlocutory appeal filed through Section 51014A9 and taken from an order denying relief under Chapter 74351 and subsection B, where there has been no proper order granting an extension of time under Section 74351? The answer to that question is yes, the Court of Appeals does have jurisdiction to consider that interlocutory appeal.
But your appeal is that the extension wasn't proper, not that the report wasn't proper, correct?
That is correct. The Section 74351 provides two means by which a party may obtain an extension in reference to providing a compliant expert report. The first is under Section 74351.
But the interlocutory appeal statute says you can't appeal the extension. So if your appeal is really about an improper extension, how do they have jurisdiction?
Well, Your Honor, the Court of Appeals here did indicate that and held that it had no jurisdiction because we were, in essence, attacking the order granting the extension of time which was signed in this case. At the time the order granting the extension of time was signed, there was no order denying the motion to dismiss, which was heard and filed contemporaneously. The first order that was signed denying the motion to dismiss was a couple of months later on August 10th of 2004. And again, all of these hearings and the orders and the briefing that went on in this case occurred just a few short months after the enactment of Chapter 74 and the new provisions found in 74351.
So did you appeal the denial of the motion to dismiss?
Yes, Your Honor. We appealed the written order timely. That denied the motion.
I guess Justice Brister's question is the appeal about an improper extension or is it about denial of the motion to dismiss?
Your Honor, it attacks the validity of the denial of the motion to dismiss because there was no proper order granting an extension of time under Section 74351. If we look at Section 51014A9, the plain language says that a person may appeal from an interlocutory order from a court that denies all or part of the relief sought by a motion under Section 74351B, except that an appeal may not be taken from an order granting an extension under 74351. There are only two ways to obtain an extension under 74351. The first is under subpart A, and that is an extension by agreement of the parties. The second is through Section 74351C, which provides for a discretionary 30-day extension of time, one 30-day extension, where a timely served expert report is found to be deficient in one or more respects regarding the elements to be contained therein.
Do you think the trial judge considered the fact that this these documents were sent to the wrong place to the insurance company and there was a clerical error. Do you think that had any role in his decision-making process? And if it did, is that wrong in itself for the judge to use that discretion?
Your Honor, I do think that the trial court, according to the record, the trial court may have considered that and indicated at the hearing that it would look at equity issues with respect to the health care liability claimant in this case. The trial court abused its discretion in doing so, however, because as this court in Ogletree versus Matthews and later in Lewis versus Funderburk has confirmed, the failure to provide a report, that is, let me just back up. There's really, under Section 74351, only two possibilities regarding a compliant report. There's either an absent report or there's a deficient report. There has been some talk about maybe there's a report that's so deficient that it may constitute, but this court hasn't taken that issue yet. Here, this case falls squarely within the first, that is, an absent report. There was, and it's undisputed, Your Honor, that there was no timely service within 120 days of
but
any
did,
medical record.
Does the record reflect whether the defendant, I mean, you know, what the insurer do with it?
The record does not reflect, Your Honor. And, in fact, the claimant at the clerk's record, page 130, in a brief filed subsequent to the first hearing, indicated that in a sworn motion that it was a clerical error that led to the report being filed within 120 days.
But I mean, and it would. I understand your position is they have to send it to me, and if they send it to somebody else who gave it to me, that's no good.
And also, Your Honor, that is correct. Also, there is nothing in the record to show that there was proper service under Rule 21A, which would be required because here it's undisputed that there was nothing received by the defendant.
Is there anything in the statute that says constructive actual notice is not good enough? In other words, normally, if you're right, in some instances you've got to actually serve, like citation, you've got to actually serve the defendant. If you never serve them, but they learn about it, that's not enough. But there's other instances where if they actually got it, the fact that it wasn't sent right, is it? How do we know which one this one is?
In this case, Your Honor, the record is clear, and it's conceded by all the parties that there was nothing received within the 120-day time period by the defendant or defendant's counsel. In fact, at the hearing, I believe, the first hearing, there was discussion that there was some concern whether it was medical records sent before suit was filed or even after suit was filed. There was really nothing further proved up, Your Honor, in the record below. But remember that the purpose of serving on the defendant or the defendant's counsel is to provide notice. Here's a report. You only have 21 days now that you have to object to the sufficiency of this report. So there has to be notice that something is being tendered to that you need to object to if you think it's not appropriate under the elements that are required to be contained within that report.
There were two motions to dismiss.
Yes, sir.
And just one order, is that right?
Just one order, yes, sir.
And the one order denied them both?
No, Your Honor. There is one order on the motion to deny. It denied, and that was the second after the second hearing. Just to back up, after the first order that was signed was the order granting an extension of time, and that's the one that the Court of Appeals said was the basis of the appeal.
Mm-hmm.
After the 30-day time period, Dr. Bodega's counsel filed a second motion to dismiss and incorporated all the same arguments from the first motion, saying this is untimely, no report was served within 120 days, and there was a discharge summary that had been served within the 30-day extended time period, and it was deficient.
And then there was an order denying that.
Yes.
But the second motion incorporated the grounds of the first motion.
Yes, it did, and the court can find that second motion at the clerk's record 153, where it incorporated the earlier motion that the failure to serve in 120 days the trial court should have dismissed the case with prejudice.
And the trial court never expressly ruled on the first motion?
Not during the hearing. And there is no written order. The only order that was signed.
So the answer is no.
Yes, sir.
The first motion to dismiss, that there was no ruling on, and then you filed another motion. Did the second motion re-urge the first motion, or was it an entirely new motion to dismiss?
It was a separately filed document that incorporated the arguments from the first motion and then briefly addressed the sufficiency of the purported expert.
Do you characterize it as a new motion to dismiss or re-urging of the first motion to dismiss?
I would characterize it as a re-urging of the first motion to dismiss with a new section added that addressed the sufficiency of the purported expert report.
And your complaint about the granting of the extension, is your position that, or are you arguing that the judge should have granted the motion to dismiss the first time?
Yes, Your Honor, and the second time. There was no written order, and a signed written judgment or order is really the absolute prerequisite to this court's exercise of appellate jurisdiction. We know from TRAP 26, for example, that the deadline to perfect an accelerated appeal, such as the interlocutory appeal in this case, is 20 days from the date the order is signed. The first order that's signed denying the motion to dismiss here was timely appealed. This court has stated in Ogletree that the legislature has denied the trial courts the discretion to either deny a motion to dismiss or to grant an extension of time when there is the complete absence of an expert report within 120 days following the filing of the lawsuit. The trial court abused its discretion when it failed to deny Dr. Bodega's motion to dismiss. When Dr. Bodega did get an order on his motion to dismiss and timely appeal that, the Court of Appeals erroneously declined to exercise jurisdiction based on the exception contained in 51014A9.
The purpose of the statute is to get early expert reports, not waste a bunch of time and money on frivolous. Find out early on if it's frivolous or substantial. How is that defeated if you can't appeal trial judge? If nothing's filed 4 months, trial judge does nothing, gives them 30 extra days. How does that extra 30 days defeat the purpose of the statute? You still would be finding out earlier, actually, assuming everybody moves fast, which didn't happen here. But assuming everybody moves fast, you get the extension happens immediately, you get the report immediately, and so now you're 5 months instead of filing. The earlier statute was 6 months, so you wouldn't defeat the purpose of the statute.
Well, and technically, Your Honor, I think you would defeat the purpose of the statute because the underlying case, even though the trial might be stayed during an interlocutory appeal, the discovery would be ongoing, for example. There would still be expenses, legal fees, and costs that would be burdened upon the defendant when the case should have been dismissed after the first motion was filed at 120 days. So I think, frankly, it does defeat the purpose that's enumerated in Section 10.11 of House Bill 4.
It's interesting. The legislature could have stayed everything during the interlocutory appeal, I suppose. Yes, so they weren't as concerned about the expenses. Otherwise, they would have stayed them.
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Otherwise, they would have stayed them, too.
Well, there are numerous types of cases that are allowed to go up for an interlocutory review
In practice, during the interlocutory, everybody kind of stands down, but in practice, right?
Generally, that does happen, Your Honor. But I think with respect to what the legislature stated within Section 10.11 and what this court said recently in McAllen, here that could be thwarted if discovery has to go forth, depositions taken because a purported report is given after the extended period. Because there was no proper order granting an extension under 74.351, the trial court did abuse its discretion. Because Dr. Bodega did timely bring his appeal under Section 51014A9 from the order denying his motion to dismiss, and there was no proper order granting an extension that's required under A9 to meet the exception, the Court of Appeals did error in concluding that it did not have jurisdiction. This court should reverse and should remand to the trial, to the Court of Appeals to consider the issue, or with an instruction to dismiss the case with prejudice and remand to the trial court to have the issue of attorney's fees and costs determined as was first sought in the original motion.
Any further questions?
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honors.
The court is ready to hear argument from the respondent.
Court, Mr. Villarreal will present argument for the respondent.
May it please the court. My name is Alberto A. Villarreal, Jr. I am from Edinburgh, Texas. I represent the original plaintiff in this case, the respondent in this appeal. We have two or three, actually, statutes that control. The statutes were properly construed by the 13th Court of Appeals. The first one is 74.351 in Section B as to the expert report. Section C also applies. However, Section 51014A9 of the statute says that jurisdiction applies only when no extension has been granted. Now, what petitioner is trying to do is get behind the language in the second part of the sentence, and it is only one sentence.
But how can an extension be granted if there's no report on file? That in itself is a violation of the statute, if you read it.
If it was exactly that and nothing more, possibly so. The court did consider that there had been a report filed prior to the lawsuit actually been filed with what we considered opposing side. We didn't think it was necessary to be dealing with more than one side. We were told this is for the insurance company, this is for the defendant at that time.
Was it sent to an adjuster for the insurance company, or was it sent to a lawyer representing the insurance company?
We were led to believe that it was actually both, if I remember correctly, Your Honor. The request, the day-to-day contact was with an adjuster. There was two or three communications, again, if I remember correctly, that requested the information so that we could probably or possibly reach a quick resolution to the case. Basically, it was, what have you got? Let's take care of it. When the lawsuit happened, because nothing further was done as far as settlement negotiations, it was done because time was running out. There were several factors that contributed to that time running out, but that's not an issue for this court. What I think is an issue for this court is that the trial court exercised the proper discretion in looking at the overall picture. There's no explanatory language in what is a proper report.
Would you agree then that if there were absolutely no report filed whatsoever or sent to the insurer or the insurer's counsel within 120 days that an interlocutory appeal could be brought from the granting of an extension and denial of the motion to dismiss?
I would not agree with that because the statute doesn't say that. 51014A9 is a one sentence section, and it does not qualify what parameters are to be satisfied.
Well, it says you can appeal from an interlocutory order that denies all or part of the relief regarding the 120-day requirement to file the expert report. There's an exception for an extension, but what I'm asking is, if there is no report filed whatsoever within the 120 days and no report was sent erroneously to the insurer or to the insured's attorney, doesn't that statute under the Civil Practice and Remedies Code give the defendant the right to appeal?
I don't believe that's what the statute says, Your Honor. I believe what A9 says is that there can be no appeal if an extension was granted. It doesn't say whether the extension would have been valid or not.
But what does the first part mean, that you can appeal an order that denies all or part of the relief sought concerning the 120-day report? What does that mean, then?
I believe it means exactly what it says, but there's an exception that qualifies it under A9 of 51014.
But the exception is for an extension under section 74.351.
Yes, Your Honor.
How is this under section 74.351? What in any part of that section authorizes an extension in these circumstances?
As I read the statute, no report being filed includes one that is deficient. So,
right. But if you mean, so even if no report is filed at all, that's still a grounds for an extension under 74.351.
If the trial court determined that an extension was warranted, yes.
So then a plaintiff could, if the trial court grants the extension, always get not 120 but 150 days to file the expert report.
Again, depending on what the trial court does with the extension request, it doesn't mean always. It means the trial court uses discretion.
And under 74.351C, regarding an extension, it says if an expert report has not been served within the period specified, because elements of the report are found deficient, the court may grant 130-day extension to cure. Now, what does the phrase elements of the report are found deficient mean? Does that not presuppose that there must be some report at least served in order to find elements of it deficient?
I don't know that it means that, Your Honor, because the statute does say in the same sentence, if no report has been filed. So it is considered not to have been filed if there is a deficiency. As far as the definition of what is a deficiency, I believe that would have to be something brought up by the defendant in his request for that dismissal based on a deficient report.
Now, I don't see no report having been filed in the language here. You're inferring that from your reading of 51.0149A9 about the extension?
Yes, Your Honor. 51014A9 doesn't give a reason for an extension as far as what's necessary. It simply says no appeal is viable if an extension has been granted. It doesn't look behind the reasons for the extension being granted. As has been brought up earlier in this court, there was a question about whether or not there was actual notice, whether there was an actual report that had been tendered to the opposing side, whether it was opposing counsel or the individual. We had to assume that they are the same. I don't think there's anyone in this room that's going to say the insurance company is not who the entity that hired the individuals that are defense counsel.
Those are two different issues. So it seems to be strained to interpret the statute that way. It seems to me it wouldn't give it any meaning that you get 120 days to do nothing. Really, because you can get it, because at the judge's discretion, you get another 30 days.
I think if the trial court found that nothing, as we all know the normal meaning, if nothing was done, the trial court would not grant the extension.
Well, some would and some wouldn't. I mean, That's the bottom line. That's what we see in the cases.
Yes, Your Honor.
Some would and some wouldn't. So that means I'm concerned about the forum shopping. We already have enough of that in Texas and have had for a long time. Now we're going to add to that. Well, what you need to do is file in a jurisdiction where trial judges don't care that you file nothing, and they'll give you a 30-day extension, which in this case actually worked out to a four-month extension, because by the time we set it for hearing and file everybody's motions and stuff, it took 4 months before the deadline. The extended 30-day deadline was actually 4 months after the original deadline. And doesn't that just encourage even more for plaintiffs to file cases in places where they know the trial judges will really don't care for this statute and won't enforce it?
Well, it may have that effect, Your Honor. In this particular case, the events occurred in Hidalgo County.
Yours is a sympathetic case. If you had a report and you sent it quick and you just got it sent to the wrong address. But, of course, we've got to worry about some less sympathetic cases where they actually don't have a report.
Yes, Your Honor. Well, I want the court to know in case the procedure in Hidalgo County is not known. We do have, I believe it's 12 or 13 district courts, in addition to six county courts of law, and we don't have any control over which court they fall in. It's purely random. And as far as the jurisdiction itself, Hidalgo County is where this event occurred. It's where both parties are from, so it was properly filed. In other possibilities, I agree with the court. There could be the possibility of abuse in forum shopping, but we don't have that before this court. Now, my concern is that we are looking behind the reasons for the extension when the statute does not provide for that. The statute says where an extension was granted, no appeal can be taken. So I am reasonably sure that by itself precludes the jurisdiction of the Court of Appeals. They construed the statutes properly in making that determination. And then subject to that being correct, Section 22.225C of the Texas Government Code then says that interlocutory appeals are finished at the appellate court level, so that then the Texas Supreme Court would not have jurisdiction. Right. So what we have is 5101.4A9 of the Texas Practice and Remedies Code, and also the Government Code at 22.225C, so that even if there was a problem with jurisdiction, which we don't think that there was, there was no jurisdiction in the 13th Court of Appeals, as pronounced by the court, then the next step in coming to this court, unless there were a couple of exceptions to that rule, then this court doesn't have jurisdiction. Now, is there a conflict? I don't know that any case has been cited that there is a conflict. The Gonzalez case, which is cited regularly in the briefs, Gonzalez versus Avalos at 907 Southwest 2nd 443, addresses the issues that are close to this case. There isn't one exactly on point, but again, it does not provide any basis for claiming that the 13th Court of Appeals was wrong in denying jurisdiction. Most of the cases that have been cited have to do with temporary injunctions. Is this a case of first impression? Well, I think it has some first impression items in it, and possibly the legislature needs to do a little more with this statute. But at this time, there is nothing in the statute that allows the appeal. There's nothing in...
Well, we always have jurisdiction to decide whether the Court of Appeals rightly found that it had jurisdiction. Otherwise, courts of appeals could just... I mean, legislature could say, got a right to interlocutory appeal. Court of Appeals say, no, we don't have jurisdiction. We're not going to do that. We always have the right to rein them in and say, no, you actually have to look at it.
Yes, Your Honor.
That would apply here.
That would apply, but I think that the statutes are very clear. Again, the biggest problem that we have is that petitioner is trying to look behind the trial court's ruling on the extension. And the trial court had that hearing and heard evidence and made a decision. Admittedly, there were 3 or 4 months time lag there, but that was not under the control of either the petitioner or the defendant at that time, which in this case is petitioner and respondent.
Counsel, let me interrupt you just a second. If the petitioner were appealing the order granting the extension, would they not have had to appeal within a certain time frame after that order was entered?
I believe it's 21 days, yes, Your Honor.
Okay, and they did not do that. That's not why we're here, is it?
That's not why we're here as far as I'm concerned, Your Honor.
Okay, so there was an order entered granting extension. They did not appeal that. Then we get down to where the final order was entered.
and there were orders entered denying the motion to dismiss at that point in time.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And so they've got an order now, and that's the order they're appealing from. The order that denying is their position.
That is correct, Your Honor.
Okay, so you're not... How is it that your position is that they're appealing the order granting the extension then when you just said they did not appeal that order?
Your Honor, I'm not saying that that's what they appealed. I'm saying that they're trying to look behind first the order denying the dismissal motion, and they're basing it on an improper extension. I'm not saying that they appealed the extension, but what they're saying is it that extension should not have been granted, and for that reason, the denial should have been granted at the trial court level. And then they appealed the denial.
They couldn't appeal the denial until they had the order entered, could they?
No, Your Honor, they could not.
They had to have an order, as counsel said earlier.
That is correct, Your Honor. But as the court just said, maybe they should have appealed the granting of the extension.
But how could they? Because your position is this statute says specifically they could not do that.
Again, Your Honor, that is correct. But what I'm saying is if their argument is going to be that the extension was incorrect, then that's what they should have appealed. They're trying to go behind what the trial court did in granting the extension in order to justify their appeal on the denial of the motion to dismiss. And I'm saying you can't do that. Right?
Are you familiar with the Brennan case?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
The Brennan case out of Texarkana 2 years ago. Are you familiar with that case?
I don't recall it, no, Your Honor.
Apparently, it's a case where the Court of Appeals exercised jurisdiction in a case just like this one, similar to this one. But you don't know enough about it.
No, Your Honor.
I'm concerned if whether this will come back up at the end of the trial. If y'all go through, if you prevail and case goes to trial, won't they still be able to argue on appeal? This case should have been final appeal. This case should have been dismissed 4 months into it because no report was served.
I don't think that they can appeal something that's already been decided by both the Court of Appeals and the Supreme Court of Texas.
If the Court of Appeals decides, but, I mean, if we decide the Court of Appeals is right, it has no jurisdiction, then they wouldn't have decided that. Your position is the Court of Appeals was right, doesn't have jurisdiction,
That
issue hadn't been decided. So we decide it at the end of the trial, that'd be a lot worse, wouldn't it?
There's already been a ruling on that, and as it turns out, we are
a trial judge, but there's not a ruling on the merits by the Court of Appeals. They said they don't have jurisdiction to decide it.
I understand.
Which
that.
Means it's postponed to the end, which means we're going to waste a lot more effort if, in fact, no report was ever signed.
Well, again, Your Honor, if there are clarifying additions to Section 5101-4A9, or even to 74351B, or actually all of 351, then maybe that will preclude those potential problems. But I don't think that this court should be making a decision based on, well, are we going to have to look at this case again later on? If the court denies it now, then as far as this case is concerned, there are no further bases for appeal as to this issue.
Counsel, do you have any further argument? Are there any further questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Counsel, if the report had been served on the defendants before suit was filed, would that then have been timely filed under the statute? It seems, as I read the statute, it says the report shall be filed not later than the 120th day after the date the original petition was filed.
Your Honor, this court clarified, I believe, in Lewis versus Funderburk that under the first version of 74351, it was 120 days after the lawsuit was filed to, and that's the provision at issue here.
So it couldn't count it. Your position is it could not count if it were filed, if they furnished the report, said here's what we have, got it to the right person, and then filed the lawsuit. That getting it to the right person still does not count.
Under the technical language of 74351, I think they would need to serve it again after the lawsuit was filed.
After the lawsuit was filed.
Yes, Your Honor.
Is your technical reading of that provision consistent with the purpose of the provision?
Probably not, Your Honor. I would concede that. And typically, not to be flippant or anything, but we try not to raise those kinds of issues because we like to refer to them as pig moves. But
was this question a pig move?
A pig move, yes, Your Honor, with all due respect to the court. But under the language, it does say after the filing of the lawsuit itself.
Well, it says actually shall not later than the 120th day. Seems like that might be inclusive of one filed before. And what I'm wondering is this. This court's recently said that in some instances an insurer's interest are congruent with those of the insured. And if you serve an insurer, and it's not, and it may or may not be in the record here, but if the insured's interests are congruent with those of the insured, and if the insurer receives the report saying, here are the problems that we allege, and that's given before the 120th day afterward, and our whole purpose in this statute is to weed out frivolous claims, but not to have the meritorious claims tossed out because of a default of some nature that was unintentional.
Yes, Your Honor.
How, as Justice Wainwright questioned, how have we enhanced the purpose of the statute?
Reflecting on it, Your Honor, the reason for notice is to make sure that because the defendant only has 21 days to file an objection if it's a deficient report, and there can be no filing of an objection if no lawsuit has been filed.
Well, but once it is filed, you could certainly have 21 days. Go ahead. You had some points to make.
Yes, Your Honor. I know that there's one case out of the Houston Court of Appeals recently, the James versus Yilmaz, Dr. Yilmaz matter, that has concluded otherwise. It stated that when a report was served prior to service of the lawsuit, then and service of the lawsuit occurs later than 21 days following the service of the report, then that doesn't count because there's no way that the defendant has had notice and can timely file its objection to a deficient report. So I believe that the service would have to be after the filing of the lawsuit to be able to make sure that all the provisions of 74351A are justified, Your Honor.
Your opposing counsel says we don't have jurisdiction. There's no conflict among the courts of appeals, no dissent, no other ground under the government code. What's your response?
Your Honor, we've cited two cases to the court, the Emeritus case and then the Theokaluthu versus Brennan matter out of Texarkana. Both of those cases on similar issues, they did have concededly, Your Honor, orders granting the extension and an order denying the motion at the same time. What those courts concluded was when there's a complete absence of the report, then there is no proper extension under 74351, and the exception to A9 does not apply because the order granting the extension is not an extension to cure a deficient report. And again, you only have two ways to get an extension. One is to cure a deficient report that was timely served, and the other is by agreement, Your Honor. Those two cases give this court conflicts jurisdiction, we believe, Your Honor.
Are there any further questions? Thank you, counsel. The cause is submitted, and the court will take a brief recess.